Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Pushcart Prize-winning poet Maggie Smith gained star status in 2016 with her viral poem, Good Bones. Long celebrated in the poetry community for her lyricism and style, but her breakout bestseller, Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change, launched her to new levels of popularity. Now with Goldenrod, Smith returns to her original craft with a powerful collection of poems that explore parenthood, solitude, love, and memory. The poems in Goldenrod celebrate the contours of daily life, explore and delight in the space between thought and experience, and remind us that we decide what is beautiful. Again, the new collection is Goldenrod, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Maggie Smith to this week's book show. Maggie, what a delight. Thank you very much for being with us.
Joe, thanks for having me.
Give us a sense of how your life changed as a result of us, meaning people, becoming aware of Good Bones, and then with Keep Moving, which did so well and hit so many people.
It's been incredibly strange, to be quite honest, because as a poet, I think we poets are used to our readership being small, but discerning and loyal. And so to kind of get outside of the readership of quote unquote poetry people with Good Bones was really strange. And then Keep Moving was a completely different project for me. I mean, I sort of made up, we're going to write essays and we're going to write some quotes and it's all going to kind of be interwoven. And that felt right to me. But I really had no idea how many people. So, you know, as a writer, it's gratifying to have a wider readership. And at the same time, the process of making new things really doesn't change, and mercifully so. I mean, I think part of my job, a big part of my job, is being a quiet observer. And so I can't let the feeling of being observed get in the way of that.
Keep Moving was your seventh book, but it was so emotional and I think impactful for so many people. You're writing about the end of your marriage. You're writing about the trauma of pregnancy loss. So there is also the subject, which obviously I think resonates with many, many people.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, I wrote that book during my hardest year personally on the planet into the pandemic during a year that was collectively one of our hardest. And in some ways, it was perfect timing. Like one thinks it's not really ideal to release a book during a pandemic when you can't get on an airplane and go to bookstores and go to universities and put physical books into people's hands and have that kind of community literary experience. But at the same time, the book coming out, you know, during the height of quarantine really made sense in a way because people were going through their own stuff and needed some courage and hope, I think. And the book seemed to show up at the right time.
So you, I mean, obviously there's a feeling of loneliness there that obviously many of us felt. You're feeling vulnerable, but thousands of people are reading this and are responding because they also feel vulnerable. It's a community coming together.
Absolutely. I mean, I felt incredibly fearful and alone going through divorce. I mean, it's a really one of the most destabilizing experiences I think a person can go through. And to have a sense of community of people reaching out, whether on social media or just getting texts or emails, where people either were going through something similar or, you know, had their own stuff, a job loss, or just trying to parent kids who were Zooming school from different rooms in their house, or having, you know, a scary diagnosis or a death loss. I mean, there are so many different things that people went through last year because it's not like the rest of life just got to stop and we all got to focus on COVID.
So while this is happening, you feel, meaning the loss of your marriage, you feel incredibly alone, but the whole world is feeling alone. So there is this sense of community that comes together.
Yeah, I felt really sort of held because of this book in a strange way. And I know when I was writing it, it never occurred to me that a drowning person could throw someone else a life preserver. You know, I was writing it when I was going through my own sort of lonely, tough time. And what I was hearing from so many people that there when they needed it, or a particular quote or essay or metaphor helped get them through a tough day or a tough couple of hours or a really hard month. And that made me feel less alone and like there was a sort of greater purpose to what I had been going through.
It seems revolutionary, and yet it makes perfect sense. But poetry and the lines that you bring to us via social media just seem to work very well.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I saw social media when I first joined Twitter, for example. I was a little snarky about it, to be quite frank. I was a little suspicious of it. I thought, this is where celebrities sell lip gloss. Like, this is not a space for poetry. And I joined mostly logistically so that when I was visiting a city and I would be at a university or in a bookstore, I could say, hey, Tulsa, I'm going to be in your town. Or, hey, you know, Los Angeles, I'm coming to do a lecture or whatever. And it was a way of reaching outside of my circle. And what I ended up finding in that space was not only a great place to share work and to find work, but a great way to build literary community. And I have now, over the past, you know, several years, made real friends that I have then gone on to meet in real life and spend time with. And a lot of those connections began in a space that I thought was quite shallow and self-promotional. And I think, like any tool, it's only as good as what you do with it. And if you use it for good, that's what it will do for you.
Maggie Smith is the author of Goldenrod Poems. It is a collection. It is out from Atria. I'm hoping you can read us the title poem, Goldenrod.
Of course. Goldenrod. I'm no botanist. If you're the color of sulfur and growing at the roadside, you're goldenrod. You don't care what I call you, whatever you were born as. You don't know your own name. But driving near Peoria, the sky pink-orange, the sun bobbing at the horizon, I see everything is what it is, exactly, in spite of the words I use. Black cows, barns falling in on themselves. You, dear flowers born with a highway view, forgive me if I've mistaken you. Goldenrod, whatever your name is, you are with your own kind. Look, the meadow is a mirror, full of you, your reflection repeating. Whatever you are, I see you, wild yellow, and I would let you name me.
I love that last line of, I would let you name me, because that just implies such trust in nature.
Oh, I love that read. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about how we so often think of nature as this thing, as being outside of us. You know, there's the human world and then there's nature, and we just need to go get into nature. It's not separate from us. We're in it. And I think thinking about it that way also helps us break down this idea of power, having power over a thing by naming it. You know, I don't know what that flower is. And frankly, it doesn't matter. What matters is that I'm sort of beholding it and I'm feeling something about it. And I'm not considering myself greater or more important than it. And I'm not trying to control it.
I like the idea, too, that there are people, I've had this conversation where people will say, well, that is goldenrod, that is an invasive, and then we'll point to something else and say, well, but that is an invasive species. Mm. But if we look at it of as you say in the poem, if we look at it as, well, that thing that's growing alongside the road that is golden in color, we're just going to call that goldenrod.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, that's the beginning of the poem is I'm no botanist. And that's just the truth. I take in nature as someone who appreciates the colors and shapes and movement of light and shadow and changes in the seasons, and not as somebody who really, quote unquote, knows. And in some ways that's okay, because I think I'm allowed to keep some wonder and some unknowing. That's okay.
One of the things that you remind us about in this collection is that you have, obviously, you're writing about your marriage and the end of your marriage. You're writing about your children and what they're going through. And you're writing about what the world is going through and what the country's going through and the difficulties. And you mention a lockdown, and you mention the fact that that there's a Muslim ban. And so there are all these things that come together, which any one of them would be overwhelming.
Yeah. I mean, but that's life.
Right.
I was talking to somebody the other day about how there are sort of more, I don't know if I'd call them political poems, but there are more poems in this book than in any of the other books I've written that address some things, some parts of this country in a more direct way than I have done in my previous work. And yet I thought about it, and I thought about those poems and all of the poems in the book that address these sort of bigger issues do so from my perspective. And it's you know, almost always a mother's perspective. I think we take in the world as whole people. So it's not like I'm watching the news and I'm feeling something as that person, and then I turn off the news and I go play with my kids and I'm able to leave the news in the living room. That's not how we live. The poems were written between 2015 and 2020. And there was a lot of living in there, both personally and culturally and politically. And we went through a lot as a country in those years. And so it's sort of all the stuff of life is in the book, and nothing is really sort of censored out as not poem material.
There are three chapters in the book, and I'm curious as to how you decide to break it up that way and to have the poems included. It's not as if there is a true thematic of this is going to be about children, this is going to be about nature, this is going to be about politics.
No, you're right. And I'm glad that you read it that way, because I tend to not like very decompartmental. I don't like compartmentalized books as a poet. So I prefer to have, say, a series of poems that all feel related, spread out from the front of the book to the back of the book, rather than have all the like poems back to back to back. And I don't know exactly why that is, except to say that I, as a reader, really enjoy feeling like a writer is leaving me a bit of a breadcrumb trail. And so later in a book, if I see a kind of poem that I've seen before earlier, I really enjoy that sense of familiarity, like, there's a signpost, I'm going the right way. And I think it helps break up the risk of monotony by having too many like things together. So when I'm putting a book together, really, I'm just doing it one poem at a time. I look through the stack and I think, what do I want the welcome mat to be? Like, what's the first poem? What's the door in? And so I try out lots of different poems and I look at them and I think, is this the door in? Is this what I want the reader to see first? And they battle it out and one wins. And then I look at that poem and I look at its tone and its imagery, and I look a lot at how it ends, because that's going to be the transition into the beginning of the next one. And so then I look through the stack and think, which poem best follows that one? And I just do that one at a time as I'm trying to build the thing. And then sometimes, you know, two don't want to play nice together and I have to kind of reshuffle and rethink things. But I like sections because it's almost like stanzas in a poem. You know, you have that white space between stanzas as a kind of relief to kind of gather yourself. And then you're exiting one room, you know, stanza is Italian for room. So in a poem, you're exiting one room and that white space between is kind of like a corridor, a little bit of a breather. Then you enter the next room. And so I really like having sections however many there are, two or three or four, in books, because I think it helps pace the reader's experience of the poems and kind of helps slow things down a bit and acts as a kind of archway from one thing to the next.
There are three poems in this collection with the name of Ohio Cento. I'm hoping you'll read the first one. But tell us first why there are three in the book with the same title.
Well, there are actually, I think, 8 or 9 Ohio Centos, and only three were selected for the book.
Uh-huh.
Because I had originally put more in and didn't quite like the balance. I like just having one little kind of amuse-bouche per section, one little taste. And so the poems, the cento form, or cento in Italian, is really a collage form. So all of the lines in these poems are by other Ohio writers, hence the Ohio cento. They're all kind of an homage to writers who were either born here or writers who are living and writing and working here right now. My work is not to have done any writing. So none of the lines that I'll read are my lines. My work is assembly. So finding one line, which is usually not a full sentence, and then thinking, okay, how does this line end? What part of speech do I need next? You know, oh, it ends on a prepositional phrase. I need to find a line from another book of poems by another Ohio poet that begins perhaps with a prepositional phrase. And let's see what we can build. And it was honestly great fun to put these together.
So let us hear the first Ohio Cento.
Ohio Cento. The sun comes up and soon the you know what will hit the you know what. But this is what it means to have our life. We need a break from this ruined country. Sometimes it feels like it has just begun and it's over. What we know of ourselves gets compressed, layered. Remembering is an anniversary. Every minute, a commemoration of being or thinking, or its opposite, a strip of negatives. Some days I don't even know how to be. I sink my feet past time and the olden tangy, as if loneliness didn't make us in some absurd blessing, if there even is an us. When are we most ourselves, and when the least? Is it too late, except to say too late, and hear the whole world take a rain check? I worry it is.
That's a beautiful reading, Ohio Cento, from the collection Goldenrod by Maggie Smith. The idea of assembling that, it could have been, I assume, brighter. It could have been more dire.
Yeah, and I played a lot with these poems. Mm. I mean, you know, you can look at one of the lines in these and imagine actually transitioning to a different line. You know, the sun comes up and soon I sink my feet past time in the olden tangy, which is halfway down the page.
Right.
So it really is, you know, sort of thinking back to Burroughs' cut-up poems where you cut strips from other people's novels or you know, music lyrics. He used David Bowie sometimes. And kind of moving them around physically on the page and thinking about what new things you can make from other people's ideas. And I like this form because I think it's a good one to try if we get stuck and don't feel particularly inspired. It's a great writer's block form because you don't have to do any writing. You just have to pull off some books from your bookshelf and start writing some things down and, you know, moving them around or using cut and paste in Microsoft Word and seeing what you can come up with. But I also think it's great in that it reminds us that originality is sort of a myth. We're all pulling from what people have done before. We're all reusing old ideas. We all see the same things. We're just trying to make new things with them. And this does that in a really direct way.
It does do it in a direct way. You were also taking the words of others, and had you not told me the story of this being other people's words, it fits into your writing and your style.
I love that you said that, because it, to me, when I read this poem, it feels like my poem.
Right.
And it feels like something I would have written, and these are things I would have said. And that's the assembly work, I think. I could have definitely pulled 20 lines from Ohio poets and put them in order, and they would not have sounded like me. So I think part of it is in the curating of the lines that you choose, like the, you know what will hit the, you know what a gift finding that line was.
There are also lines in this that are so declarative. We need a break from this ruined country. Well, end of story.
Yep.
Period.
There's the poem. I mean, it's, you know, that sums up a lot of the feeling in some of these poems in Goldenrod. You know, it's, wow, it's been a, you know, it was a tough period personally, but at the same time, there was this other layer. And as a person, it's hard to process, but as a mother, it's been particularly difficult to process, because I'm supposed to be the cruise director here. I'm supposed to be the comforter and the it's going to be fine, everything's fine person. And it's, you know, these last few years, it's been increasingly difficult to be reassuring as a parent. And a lot of these poems kind of grapple with that.
Is there a whiplash feeling then when you go out, even on a, let's say, a Zoom tour, and people in the audience tell you how reassuring your work is to them?
Sometimes. I mean, people say your poems always comfort me. And I think, gosh, my poems are like a Q&A with no A. So many questions. And often I go to the page with 100 questions. And when I'm done with a poem, I leave the page with 200 just better articulated questions. But I think, you know, I don't, it's in some ways, it's none of my business what readers get from my work. You know, how it makes them feel is really none of my business, because once I've finished it, my work is done. But I think that maybe some of the comfort or reassurance that readers get from these poems is about not feeling alone. You know, not that the poems tell them everything is fine, but that the poems remind them that everything isn't, but could be again. And it's maybe it sort of mirrors the way that they've been thinking about things but couldn't quite articulate.
Mm-hmm.
That does something for me. If I read something and I just feel seen, you know, oh my gosh, that's exactly what that feels like. Or I've completely had that experience, or I've never been able to come up with the right metaphor for X, but this person has just done it for me. I think that's comforting regardless of how difficult the subject matter might be.
So let's explore that for a moment. So if you want people to interpret it the way they want to interpret it, obviously that's very cool. Are you writing at all for the audience? Are you interested at all in writing for the reader? Or is it always writing for you and the catharsis that comes from that?
Well, I don't know that I would call it catharsis. And I don't want to sound like this is a closed circuit. But I really don't think about the audience when I'm writing. And not because I don't care about readers enjoying the poems or getting something out of them. I know myself well enough that if I thought too much about who was going to read the things and where they might land and whose hands they might end up in, I might never finish a poem.
Mm.
You know, if I had known how many people would read Good Bones, if someone had told me when I was drafting that poem on a legal pad in a Starbucks that Meryl Streep would read it at Lincoln Center, I never would have finished it, because it never would have been ready for her. And so, yeah, it never would have been ready for that much exposure. And so it's better for me, I think, as a writer, to have a conversation with my own mind on paper, to get to a point with the poem where I feel like it's done the work it came to do. It's surprising to me.
Mm.
It's doing its job, which is not a job I gave it. It just does what it showed up to do, regardless of what I might have had in mind. And then what happens after I send it into the world, it's kind of like, you know, pushing a boat down a river, and I have no idea who's downstream, and I don't know what they'll think of the boat or if the boat will even be floating by the time it reaches them. But I did my job. And so it's just incredibly gratifying and always surprising for me to hear where the poems go and what they might do for other people. I think it's the way I process things. And it's interesting because I don't keep a diary. I'm not a journaler. So I don't actually write to process everything, because I think if I did that, I'd probably have a daily little book that I wrote in. And so if something was troubling me or if I was worried about something, I would have a place to take it. But really, I don't do any writing unless I plan to share it later. I mean, when I sit down to write a poem, I may never share it, but my intention is that it's not just going to live in that little notebook forever. I mean, my hope is always that it will someday be ready to be kicked out of the nest. And I do think I need to write. You know, when people ask, why do you write poems? I sometimes joke that I'm not good at anything else, which is kind of true. I mean, I'm a decent cook and I'm pretty funny, but I don't really have any other talents. So thank goodness I found something I can kind of do. But also, yes, like it, I don't know how to turn it off, I guess is the other way of saying it. So it's not just when things are bothering me. If I'm walking my dog, you know, on a really muggy day, and I look up and I see something about the way a tree is making a shadow on the ground, I get a scrap of language in my head. I hear a phrase or a line and I have to get it down. And if I'm lucky, that thing will pick up momentum and grow into something, whether it's that day or the next week or sometimes 6 months later. I don't know how to turn off the thing in me that sees or hears or smells or thinks about things and then tries to make it into some little concise and cohesive whole. That's just what I do.
Maggie Smith is the author of Goldenrod Poems. It is a collection. It is out from Atria. Maggie Smith, a delight to have you on this week's program. I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you. This was a joy.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.